for this Legends and Lessons for someone named the Shla. What an interesting name, the Shla. People might be familiar with the name the Shla. Many assume or think that they're actually descended from the Shla. Anyone here think that they're descendants of the Shla? No?
My neighbors do.
The neighbors? Okay. A lot of Horowitzes or Hurwitzes or even Gwurtzes might be connected all the way back to the Shla. But the truth is, they're not really connected to this they are connected to this Shla, but they're really going back to his great-grandfather. And for that, we have to take a step back. We know through all these classes that oftentimes these people have nicknames not because that's what their actual, their family names, not because that's what their actual family name was, but because maybe a descendant later on took on that name and this sort of retroactively applies back to the original. Here, actually, we can trace the placement of his last name. And it wasn't through him, but rather his namesake. His name was Rabbi Yeshaya Halevi Horowitz, or Hurwitz, and he was born in 1558 in Prague, although the Hebrew Wikipedia article said he was born in Lublin. I don't think that's true. Just seems like, based on most sources, he was born in Prague, which is in the Czech Republic, but was in the Czech Republic. And he was born to a Reb Avram, who was the son of Reb Shabtai Shechtel Horowitz. He was the son of the original Rabbi Yeshaya Halevi Horowitz. The reason I say that is because the original Yeshaya Halevi Horowitz was actually not from Prague. He was from Horowitz. Hurwitz was a town also in the Czech Republic, and this Rabbi Yeshaya Halevi ultimately became not only wealthy for himself, but wealthy for the entire town. One thing led to another, unclear how it happened, but that Rabbi Yeshaya Halevi Horowitz ends up moving from Horowitz to Prague. And whenever that happens, so then oftentimes, not whenever, but oftentimes when that happens in those days, you not only change your city, but you're known by your previous city. Oh, that's the Hurwitzer. That's the guy from Hurwitz, right? That's how they would say it. So this Rabbi Yeshaya Halevi, the original, right, in the early 1500s, moves to Prague and assumes the last name, or the, I guess, moniker at that time, of Hurwitz, like the guy from Hurwitz. And then it sticks, and actually Rabbi Yeshaya Halevi had a last name Hurwitz. This happens to a lot of people. A lot of people that relocate, especially in Ashkenazic Jewry, they assume these last names based on the city that they came from. Trying to think of others. he has a colleague later on, also in Prague, Rev Shlomo Ephraim Lunchitz. And you know who Rev Shlomo Ephraim Lunchitz is? He's better known as the Kliyakar, or the Olos Ephraim. You probably know him as the Kliyakar, published in most Mikraos Gedolos nowadays. So he also was in Prague at the same time. He actually died before him, as we'll see soon. He also had a last name, Lunchitz. There's also, I don't actually know how old the Maharami Padua is. There's also another rabbi, Meir Katzenelnbogen, who was from a place called Katzenelnbogen. But okay, enough with last names. He's born this hour tonight. Rabbi Yeshaya Halevi Horowitz is born in 1558 to a Rav himself, Rav Avram Horowitz. Now, it could be that the misnomer that he was born in Lublin comes from the fact that his father early on moves the family to Lublin and teaches him. He becomes one of the Rebbeim at the yeshiva in Lublin, which is in many ways the headquarters of the Ashkenazic rabbinate. Many other rabbis are in this general area, but you might not know the names. Rav Avram Horowitz, however, was a student of none other than Rav Moshe Isserles. So what's interesting, what's important to know about the difference between Prague and Lublin, Prague is in the Czech Republic, but Lublin is in Poland. And once you get into Poland, so you are accessing the Polish Jewry, which at that time was led by the Rav Moshe Isserles, the Rama that we know and love, in Krakow. So then you're in the same country. So Rav Avram Horovitz also learned by the Rama, now became his own Rebbe in the yeshiva of Lublin, teaches his son along with other notable rabbis of Ashkenazic Jewry of the time. They all together teach this Rebbe Yeshaya Halevi Horovitz. He obviously has a certain a certain genius to him, and he becomes renowned in the communities there. So much so that at the young age of 32, he's already, we have documented already his signature on some, formidable is the right word, but instrumental or seemingly instrumental type of document issued by the Vad Arba Arasos. You might be familiar with that. We've talked about it before, the Council of Four Lands. And I always say, I don't really remember what the four are because there really aren't four. At that time, there were really different areas than they were land. They weren't countries. There's like little Poland, and then there's big Poland, and then there's, Galicia, and then there's, Czechoslovakia, I don't know. There are generally four areas of Lithuanian Jewry that make up the Vad Arba Arasos. At some point, it's called the Vad Chamesh Arasos, the Council of Five Lands. I don't remember what was added in. Especially back then, all of these towns and all of these countries were sort of reassumed by different powers as history continued. So either way, what we know about Rav Shai Levi Horovitz is that at the young age of 32, he's already involved in the Vad Arba Arasos. He's taken the mantle of a leading rabbinic figure and has signed on to this specific legislation. What was this legislation? We've talked about this before. Maybe we talked about it by the Kli Yakar, that there was a decree given by the Vad Arba Arasos to try to stop the common tendency of rabbis to buy their rabbinates. Right? Back then, in order to, there are only so many rabbis, So many positions for rabbis to take. And therefore it became competitive to the extent that some rabbis, if they had the money, the wherewithal, and the, political savvy, they would buy their positions, literally buy their positions. And the Vad Arba Arasos comes out in 1590, which is when he is 32 years old, Rabbi Yeshua Levi Horovitz, and says, no more, you cannot buy. Now, did that actually stop? I'm sure there was some under-the-table dealings or a little protexia, as we say today, that got different rabbis their jobs, but at least in theory, the Vad Arba Arasos was taking a stand. Probably before that, it's unclear. We know that he had a bunch of different rabbinic posts. It's unclear to me when each of them happened. We know that at some point he's in Vienna and he marries the daughter of a wealthy man named Avram Mual. Unclear how to say his name. In Hebrew, there's a vav there, but I don't know how to say it. Moyel? I don't know. Either way, his daughter Chaya marries Rabbi Yeshaya Levi Horovitz in Vienna. I know he was also at some point he was appointed as an Av Beis Din in Austria. I don't think those coincided because that was only in 1602. But he had made his way into different communities. So for instance, there's another community, Posen, I think we've talked about before. Rabbi Kiva Eger, I think, was from Posen. So that's somewhat of a prominent community. He's in other places too, here and there, between the years of, I assume through the 20s, the 1580s, through the beginning of the 1600s, he goes to different places. Ultimately, his biggest position, at least for the moment, is when he was appointed as the rabbi in none other than Frankfurt am Main. Frankfurt was I'm sure Steve Lortz loves that. Frankfurt am Main is now known to be sort of the original mothership of Ashkenazic Jewry. All of our Yeki Minhagim that we know of originate from Frankfurt. I'm sure if, Aviva Cohen was here, she could tell us all about Frankfurt am Main. She has a whole book her husband published. Either way, so Frankfurt am Main, is the source for a lot of Yeki Minhagim. This is even predates all of that stuff. It predates all of that. Obviously, it was a formidable town for many years. for many, I shouldn't say just years, centuries, all the way back to the early, I believe, 1400s, there was a certain community in Frankfurt. Am Main means along the Main River, if I'm not mistaken. And Frankfurt was, there was an established little community there. You know, we use this phrase now when we think of something sort of negative, but there was a Jewish ghetto in Frankfurt, which at the time was not a negative thing. It was just, you know, that's where the Jews lived. And it was in some ways dictated by the local authorities that that's where the Jews should live, not as a bad thing, but actually as a good thing, that we will protect you, stay here, this is where the Jews get to live, nobody can bother them over there, that kind of thing. And you can still go there, it's the actual place, Frankfurt. Yes, Steve, you have something to say? You have to unmute.
There were several towns around Frankfurt that were part of Frankfurt.
Okay, it could very well be that because Frankfurt was a very, at least the actual place of Frankfurt Am Main was somewhat small, and therefore I assume that as they branched out, they would go into these surrounding satellite communities that sort of, you know, just like Oak Park is called Detroit, you know, so they would also have, they would be called Frankfurt even though they weren't literally Frankfurt. So yeah, definitely possible. He becomes the rabbi of Frankfurt in 1606. It's going way back. Now, anyone who really knows their history about Frankfurt Am Main, which I do not, but anyone who really knows that 1606 is only a few years before a very fundamental shift in the reality of Frankfurt for the Jewish people, and that is in 1614. In 1614, there's something called the Fetzmilch Uprising. I have no idea how to actually pronounce it. The Fetzmilch Uprising was started by a man named Vincent Fetzmilch. I don't know if I'm saying that right or not. Fetzmilch, maybe? I don't know. This guy was a baker, non-Jewish baker, and at the time there was somewhat of a dispute between him along with the other guilds. The guilds were sort of like the artisans or the people with careers. You know, you can think of it nowadays as like the union. I don't know if that's a good example or a good parallel or not. But the guilds, they had them, you know, I don't know if this is a good association, but I associated along with sort of like the landsman shops. That then when they came over to America, they had these different groups that would sort of, you know, vouch for different communities. So these guilds sort of had their little workers' unions for different careers. The Baker's Guild and the Goldsmith Guild. That's how I assume that's what it was like. I don't know for sure. So this Fetzmilch was a baker, and he was actually the spokesperson for all the guilds, all the workers' unions, and they were upset because there was a certain, seems like there was a certain manipulation being done to the price of a lot of the goods. And this manipulation was maybe for tax purposes, or maybe it was for, you know, manipulating the economy one way or another. So this Vincent wanted to create a different kind of economic, you know, determinant for the marketplace, especially apparently on the grain. Beyond that, he wanted to regulate the interest rate that people could charge, most notably the Jews could charge. He wanted to limit how much interest the Jews could make. At that time, we know the Jews were very, you know, popular in those centuries, that they were the tax collectors mostly because they couldn't do any other jobs, right? They were forced into that because there was nothing else to do. They wouldn't let them be the bakers or the slaughterers or whatever. So, I don't actually know, the lawyers or the accountants or the doctors. So, Jews are always going to find a way to make money, and the way to make money was through usury, through being the not just the tax collectors, but the loan sharks, and then they would earn interest. So this Vincent wanted to regulate the Jewish interest charge. I think I saw 50%. He wanted to lower it by 50%, which is, you know, substantial. Ultimately, all of his demands were not just not met, but they were rejected. Right? It's not just like they ignored him, but the politicians and the elites of the time said, no, sorry, to no go. They, as you can imagine, were not happy about this. In fact, it wasn't just from the local authorities, but the Emperor Matthias himself of the Holy Roman Empire cracked down on this guy and said, absolutely not. Well, this guy was not happy about that, and he called his bluff. And instead of, you know, acquiescing, he starts a riot with all these commoners, all the citizenry, and they basically attack the Jews. Where else? Who else are we going to attack? They attack the Jews in the Frankfurt Jewish ghetto, and this is the year 1614. I believe it was in September, maybe. And he kicks all of them. How many Jews were in the Frankfurt Jewish ghetto at that time? You want to guess how many Jews lived in the Frankfurt ghetto? This is sort of the, you know, as I said before, the mothership of Ashkenazic Jewry. But really, at this time, it wasn't, what it ends up being. At that time, there was 1,380 Jews living in the Frankfurt ghetto, which is a substantial amount for 1614. But, you know, when we think of, you know, bustling Jewish cities, especially in the last 200 years, we don't think of that few Jews. So about 1,400 Jews are forced out of their homes. Their homes are then looted and destroyed. They are ultimately, I forgot where they stayed overnight that night, but then the next day they were kicked out entirely. The rioters kicked them out entirely, and this makes, as you can imagine, a big scene. Makes a big scene to the extent that the Emperor Matthias, you know, shoots back at them and says, you can't do that. Fights back against them, and then tells the Jews, don't worry, I've got your back. And he brings the Jews back to Frankfurt. He brings the Jews back within, I don't know, a few days. He brings the Jews back to Frankfurt, and he puts up some sign that says the Jews are protected. It was some kind of, you know, symbol of the government. I don't remember, some eagle or something I read somewhere. And basically to say, don't mess with the Jews anymore. This was unprecedented that a Christian governing body would protect the Jewish people. It was really unprecedented. But it happened here in 1614. It helps that this Fetzmilch was actually, you know, rebelling against the government itself. So I guess the Jews, you know, the common enemy, you know, they helped out. But what ultimately happens is that not only do they bring the Jews back, but they actually take Fetzmilch and his other co-conspirators, and they burn them out in the stake. They execute them, burn them, but they execute them out in the town square for all to see and to be to see the example of it. It should be noted that I also read that while he brought the Jews back, he promised them that they would get their they would get their finances recouped, but they never did. The Jews never make their money back. But at least their survival was ensured. They're protected physically, and therefore the Jews were, you know, take what you can get type of thing. Meanwhile, during the reshuffling, Rev Yeshayahu Alevi Horovitz is saying to himself, I don't want to deal with this anymore. And he leaves. Where does he go? He goes back to his old stomping grounds, at least according to most. He goes back to Prague. He goes back to Prague. And when he gets to Prague, he's already very prominent. 1614, he is at this point in his 50s, and he's gained much prominence in his rabbinic reputation. And they want him to be the rabbi. But there's only one issue, which is there's already a rabbi in Prague, and his name is Rav Shlomo Ephraim Lunchitz, also known as the Kliyakar, or the Olos Ephraim. And he is a formidable rabbinic presence unto himself. So what they do is, because they know that the Kliyakar is somewhat, you know, elderly at the time, so they say, why don't you be co-rabbis? So for a few years, Rav Shlomo Ephraim Lunchitz and the Shla, who would ultimately be known as the Shla, maybe Yeshayahu HaLevi Horowitz, were actually co-rabbis in Prague, which is just a funny thing to think about. You know, the intersection of different rabbis that you never associate with each other, but they literally shared a pulpit. I don't know, pulpit, but they shared an office. And the Kliyakar dies in 1619, a few years later. And then for the next couple of years, Rav Yeshayahu HaLevi Horowitz is the sole rabbi of Prague, which is itself a big city in the Czech Republic. In 1621, unclear how, but Rav Yeshayahu HaLevi Horowitz's wife, Chaya, who we said was the daughter of the wealthy merchant in Vienna, so she dies in 1621. I guess at that point, maybe she was in her 60s, so it's not so crazy, but she dies, and Rabbi Yeshua Levi Horowitz says, well, I'm going to take this opportunity to move on to the next stage of my life. Now, at this point, if I'm going to fill in the gaps a little bit, it would seem to me that Rabbi Yeshua Levi Horowitz had a gradual interest develop in Kabbalah. Kabbalah, as we know, is mysticism. And in Ashkenazic Jewry, you don't find a lot of mystics. Mysticism, Kabbalah, is typically at this time reserved for the Sephardic Jews. You know, it came to prominence, or it came to light, really, by Rabbi Moshe de Leon in the Sephardic Jewry, I think in the 1400s, maybe a little earlier than that. Maybe earlier than that, 14th century. And it's only, you know, built upon since then. And not getting into sort of the controversy of where it came from and who authored it, whatever, but the point is that was typically for Sephardic Jews. Rabbi Yeshua Levi Horowitz is certainly not a Sephardic Jew. And yet he strikes up this interest in it. And after his wife Chaya dies, so he sets out that he's going to make his way to the land of Israel, which is, on its own right, somewhat of a Kabbalistic even thought. Later on, we'll see that this is actually the case from what he writes in his Sefer. But for the time, it would seem to me, I haven't seen this anywhere, it would seem to me that one of the main motivations for Rabbi Shaul Levi Horowitz to go to Israel was specifically to go learn or, you know, to be involved in more Kabbalistic learning. He was already a formidable rabbi in the sort of the traditional sense. So he goes towards Israel. He doesn't actually make it to Israel right away. He stops off somewhere else also. I think I saw that he stopped off in Venice on his way. I'm not sure if geographically that works out. I don't know my geography well enough to see if you would go through Italy to get to Israel from there, from Prague. But he does settle a little bit in Aleppo, Syria. Aleppo is most famous for its manuscript of the Sefer Torah, called the Aleppo Codex, one of the, if not the oldest surviving manuscript of the Sefer Torah. And I believe they found it in the Cairo Geniza, if I'm not mistaken. But it's from Aleppo. I don't know how they know that. I don't know who knows what. But the fact is that that's what Aleppo is known for. But at the time, there was somebody else in Aleppo that Rabbi Yeshua Levi Horowitz was there for, and that was Rabbi Shmuel Vital. Now, the name Vital might sound familiar, and it's because of his father. Rabbi Shmuel Vital's father was Rav Chaim Vital. Rav Chaim Vital is most well known for being the main student of the Arizal. The Arizal, Rav Yitzchak Ashkenazi, was that his name? Yeah, I think it was Rav Yitzchak. Yeah, I think so. Either way, so the Arizal was really the one who made most accessible the Kabbalah that we know today. Kabbalah was somewhat esoteric. It was all sort of pieced together from different excerpts from the Zohar, from, you know, that came to light a couple hundred years beforehand. And the Arizal not rewrites, but sort of puts it in digestible terms. And there are theological implications to how he says it, and, you know, different aspects of how he says it that are worth delving into. Suffice it to say, I am not the person to ask for these things. What I do know is that he writes a lot of this in a sefer called Eitz Chaim, or at least Rav Chaim Vital from the Arizal writes it down in a book called the Eitz Chaim. His son, Rav Shmuel Vital, I believe, was living in Aleppo at the time. And Rav Yeshua Levi Horowitz, on his way to Eretz Yisrael, says, oh, it's not so far off to stop in Syria for a little bit. He stops in Syria and learns Kabbalah with Rav Shmuel Vital, who is the son of Rav Chaim Vital, who literally wrote the book on the most commonly used ideas of Kabbalah. So he learns it right from the source, the concept of Kabbalah. And ultimately, after that, after he learns Kabbalah from Rav Shmuel Vital, he moves on to Eretz Yisrael. I saw one place that before he moves to Eretz Yisrael, he can't actually move there until he's married. This is based on a Ramban I believe the Ramban says it about Rachel dying right where she did, because Yaakov couldn't live in Eretz Yisrael when marrying sisters. Once you're in Eretz Yisrael, there's a certain, there's a certain requirement to follow the Torah more than outside of Eretz Yisrael, and at that point, the Torah was not exactly the Torah that we have, but that's what the Ramban says. So I don't know if it's connected to that theory, but apparently Kabbalistically, there's a benefit of living in Eretz Yisrael when you're married, as opposed to being single in Eretz Yisrael, which is, frowned upon, or there's, again, it's Kabbalistic, so I can't tell you. But he marries a woman named Chava, unclear exactly who she is, but she's the daughter of a man named Eliezer. And ultimately, they move to Yerushalayim in 1625 at this point. Remember, his first wife, Chaya, died in 1621, so he's been wandering a little bit for the next few years. He ends up in, at least by 1625, probably a little bit earlier than that, maybe 1623 or something like that. I think I saw that date somewhere. With Chava, he moves to Yerushalayim, and anyone who knows anything about Jerusalem at that time, it was not exactly the Jerusalem that we have today. It was under the Ottoman Empire. It was not very well-to-do, a lot of poverty, a lot of hunger, and not many Jews generally. Even by the time, even the Ramban's time, a few hundred years earlier, wasn't very good. To the extent where that actually has halachic ramifications. Tosfos famously says in one place that while the mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael comes upon everybody, nowadays it's too dangerous to go to Eretz Yisrael. It's too dangerous to live in Eretz Yisrael. That's Tosfos. Tosfos could be anywhere from the 1100s, the 1200s, to the 1300s. But the point is that Eretz Yisrael was not really the flourishing place that we know it today. Of course it wasn't. But at that time, it was actually very difficult to live in Eretz Yisrael, and specifically in Yerushalayim. I think we talked about the Ramban, and when he gets to Yerushalayim, he's very upset and distraught over what the Jewish people look like over there, and tries to help them out, etc. But when Rabbi Yishai Levi Horowitz gets there to Yerushalayim, he also noticed the poverty, but he never noticed what would come from the situation there. First of all, when he gets there, it happens to have been a Shemitah year. You can look these things up. I didn't do the math. But apparently it was a Shemitah year, and all the Jews there were so hungry, so poverty-stricken, that they wanted to be lenient about Shemitah. And Rabbi Yishai Levi Horowitz was not the one to be lenient about anything. And he was machmir, and he said, no, you have to keep Shemitah. And I don't know if they listened or they didn't listen, but that was his first real, coming on the scene moment where he basically said, you have to keep Shemitah this year too. Now, while he was in Yerushalayim, something very interesting happens. There was an Ottoman official there. What was his name? I want to say, I don't know if it was a title or that was his name. His name was Pasha. And that Ottoman official was pretty nice to him. It was hard to figure this out, but comparing different sources, it seems like the actual Ottoman official that was in Yerushalayim was nice to him. But there was this Arab merchant, and his name was Ibn Farouk, this rich Arab, that bribed the governor of Damascus to come to Yerushalayim and take over. He brought 300 soldiers with him. He takes over Yerushalayim and kidnaps 15 rabbis, one of whom is Rabbi Yishayahu HaLevi Horowitz, the man we're talking about today. And it just so happens to be that they not only kidnapped him, but it was actually part of a larger ploy for making money. They kidnapped him and ransomed him to the Jewish community, knowing the Jews care about their own. And the only problem was the price was so exorbitant, they couldn't even afford it. The Jewish people, as I said before, were poverty-stricken. They were poor. They could not afford to release these 15 rabbis. And they pleaded with the governing officials, and they got it to a lower money amount, to the extent that they were able to release Rabbi Yeshayahu Alevi Horowitz, and ultimately he decides, maybe Yerushalayim is not for me, I'm going to Tzfat, and I'm going to be over there. Now, might he have already been designated or destined to go to Tzfat in the first place if he was going to Eretz Yisrael for Kabbalah purposes? Could be. Unclear exactly whether he was going there originally or whether he decided there to go there only after this whole event. Some say that he actually wanted to go to Tzfat because he believed in bringing the Geula. If you, as we later on read from the book that he writes during this time period, the one book which becomes his magnum opus, called the Shnei Luchot HaBris, which becomes his nickname, the Shlach, Shin Lamed Hei, Shnei Luchot HaBris. So he writes in there about the importance of Eretz Yisrael and the destiny of Eretz Yisrael, and words about other things too, as we'll see in a second. But it's possible that he was going to Tzfat with greater aspirations than just learning Kabbalah. He ends up in Tzfat. He then goes to Tveri. I'm not sure why he left Tzfat. I don't remember. And he really only spends a few years in Eretz Yisrael. He dies in the year 1630. He's buried near the Rambam and Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's kever, I assume also there for Rabbi Akiva's kever. That's on the 11th of Nisan. So today is, what, the 4th of Nisan, something like that. So in about a week from now is his yahrzeit. Although that itself is somewhat up for debate. We assume his yahrzeit is the 11th of Nisan of that year 1630. But as I mentioned before, he's best known for the book that he wrote while he was in Eretz Yisrael in Tzfat and Tveria, called the Shnei Luchot HaBris. He wrote other things too. And the truth is that if you look at the Shlach, I don't know if we have a Shlach. I don't think we have one. But if we did, I don't even know what shelf I would put it on. If one were to open up the Shlach, you'll find a lot of different sections, almost like they're completely different books within this book. The Shnei Luchot HaBris includes within it Divrei Torah on the Parsha. It includes general Musar. It includes an alphabetical, really pill about different concepts. It includes ideas about Eretz Yisrael. It includes Halakha. I think I said Musar. And it includes Kabbalah. A lot in this book. If you open up the book, it's all over the place. And then holidays also, and Gemaras, he has a whole section on different Gemaras. So there's a lot in it. But it becomes so popular that not only does it ultimately become the foundation, not foundation, but a very influential book for Hasidus, but even for non-Hasidim, before Hasidus came around, it was learned by regular people. I don't know if people know this woman named Gluckel of Hamelin or Hamelin. People know Gluckel? I don't know if that's how you say your name. Gluckel. Gluckel was a wealthy businesswoman in Germany who wrote books. She wrote a book. It has different parts to it. Different. I don't know if they're called chapters or whatever. I've never written the whole thing. I think I have it at home. But so she writes books, and in the book she talks about her husband Chaim, who died, Orthodox, regular Jew. And she talks about what it means to be a Jewish woman in which is fascinating. Jewish woman in Germany. If I remember, I believe her yahrzeit is in Elul, so maybe we can talk about her one day. She's certainly legendary and worthwhile of some research. So she writes in one of her books about her husband Chaim. It's like an autobiography. She writes in her book about Chaim, her husband, on his deathbed in 1689, maybe even 1688, he read on his deathbed the Shlach. That was his reading material when he was on his deathbed, was the Shnei Luchot HaBris. The Shnei Luchot HaBris was only printed in 1648 for the first time by the Shlach's son, Reb Shabtai Shestel Horowitz, named after his great-grandfather. And therefore, within 40 years, it becomes so central to Jewish living, even in Germany, right? Because he's, in Eretz Yisrael. He came from Prague. I believe his son actually stayed in Prague, something like that. But the book makes its way to Germany. We have this, just a fascinating personal account of someone's husband. Now, they were wealthy, so it's possible that they had a lot of books that other people didn't have. But her husband loved this book, the Shlach, and read it on his deathbed. There's a second There's a second publishing, which was published in 1698, which is not so important, but to me, at least, doesn't seem so significant. But to those who are well attuned to Hasidus, you'll know that the year 1698 is when the Baal Shem Tov was born. And they make a connection between the Shlah being printed in 1698 and the Baal Shem Tov being born in 1698. I don't exactly know what the connection is supposed to be, but the point is that the Shlah incorporates a lot of Kabbalistic ideas into Musar ideas, and that becomes somewhat of an influential work for Hasidus later on. So that is the Shlah in a nutshell. The Shlah really has two different lives. He has his Ashkenazic life, and then he has his, you know, Mekubal life, or post-Fetzmilch life from before 1614, and then post-1614, or really post-1621 when his wife died. So it's only the last 10 years of his life, but he's most well known for what he does in those last 10 years, which is write the Shnei Luchos HaBris. So I already mentioned that the Shnei Luchos HaBris is all over the place. It's got different kinds of ideas. Some of them are very esoteric. You won't be able to understand them. Some of them are very harsh and stringent, and you wouldn't be able to keep to them. And then some of them are really nice drushas. And by the way, a lot of them also, you know, are important sources for minhagim that we have, whether they're Kabbalistically infused or not. Even this week, I'm talking about, between Mincha Amar, I'm talking about the Ner Tamid that we have in the front of the Aron Kodesh. So the Shlag explains that minhag. He's probably one of the first ones that goes through the purpose of that minhag. It's brought down here and there, but it's not really explained until the Shlag comes along. So he does a lot of that also, explaining the purpose or the reasoning behind some of the minhagim that we have in the Shlag, in the Shnei Luchos HaBris. You might also be familiar with some of the Tfilos of the Shlag, right? Isn't the Shlag the one that does the Tfilos Haman, Reina? Is that him? The Shlag does the Man, or he just does the Birkas HaBanim in Sivan? There's a Tfilos HaShlag that's well known in Sivan that you say for your children, for the success of your children. He's not the one that says the Man. Who's the Parsha Saman? I don't remember who wrote that. Okay, either way. The Shlag writes has a bunch of different things. He wrote a Siddur. The Siddur was called Shari Shemayim. The reason why it's called Shari Shemayim apparently is he wrote it, or he published it, or publicized it, I don't know. The first week he was in Eretz Yisrael, he came to Eretz Yisrael on a Friday, and that Friday, they say, was Parshas Vayetze. And in Parshas Vayetze is when Yaakov has the dream with the ladder, and he says the words, Vizesh Shar HaShamayim. So he writes the Siddur, and he names it Shar HaShamayim based on the pasuk of when he got to Eretz Yisrael. Either way, in the Siddur, he has a bunch of different tfilos, including that tfilo that people say, was it Rosh Chodesh Sivan, maybe? Yes, Rosh Chodesh Sivan. Right before the Shlosh Magbal. So, he has a lot of different types of things in the Shla. But just to finish off tonight, a little bit of a lesson about Pesach from the Shla. This is one of my favorite ideas. One of my fan favorite ideas. People love this concept, so hopefully you'll get something out of it. I'm not sure if this is entirely fleshed out by the Shlah or by others who then come to extrapolate from the Shlah, but suffice it to say, the Shlah tells us that when it comes to the mitzvot of the Seder, we have two most prominent mitzvot. We have Matzah, and we have the Dalakos. The other mitzvahs also, obviously, Karban Pesach, back in times of Beis HaMikdash. We have the mitzvah of Maror. We have Karpas and Karosos. We have other aspects, but the two main mitzvahs people look at that sort of run through the whole Seder are Matzah and the Dalakos. How many Matzahs do we have? Three Matzahs. How many cups of wine do we have? Four cups of wine. Says the Shlach, coincidence? I think not. How many forefathers do we have? Not four. Forefathers is spelled F-O-R-E. How many forefathers do we have? Three. How many four mothers do we have? That actually works. We have four. Says the Shlah, the three matzahs represent the three fathers, and the three cups of wine represent the three mothers, but it goes much deeper than that. Says the Shlah, there's a Gemara in Nida Daf Lamed. I think it's in Daf Lamed, if I remember correctly. Leave biology out of this. or anatomy out of this. We're just going to say what the Shloah says. We're just going to say what the Gemara says, and we'll take it from there. The Gemara tells us that the father of a child, right? There are three components of three creators of a child. There's the father, the mother, and Hashem himself. I like to think of it as the father and the mother create the physical being, and Hashem puts the ruach, that's what the Gemara says, puts the ruach in what I like to call the batteries, right? The father and the mother create the thing, and then the Hashem puts in the batteries. Kivyachal. And says the Gemara, what does the father contribute? What does the mother contribute? Again, leave biology out of this. I don't need to hear it from the science majors. The father, says the Gemara, contributes the white of the person. The white. What does that mean, the white of a person? So the Gemara says that includes the white of the eye, it includes the sinews of the body, it includes the bones of the body, and it includes the brain. Nowadays we know that's what we call white matter of the brain, or gray matter of the brain. So the father provides the white matter of the brain. What does the mother provide? Says the Gemara, the mother provides the odem, sheva adam. She gives the redness of a person. That's the Gemara says, that's the flesh. It's the color of the eye, and it's the blood of the person. I might got the sinews mixed up, I don't remember. So says the Shloah, the mother contributes the blood, the father contributes the mind. What is the blood? The blood, the mother, represents the emotional aspect of a person. As we know, women, not getting political here, but women, by and large, are more emotionally inclined, or more emotionally attuned than men. Men, on the other hand, are more cerebral. They don't have as much of a sensitivity to their emotions or to others' emotions. They're more sort of, utilitarian. How do I do this? Functional. How do I do this? How do I figure this out? It's like everything's a math problem with men. Right? So the woman represents the emotion that's represented from the blood. Think of the blood of a person sort of running through their body when they get excited or when they get angry. Right? That's the emotional impulse. It's through the blood. You have the father, which is cerebral, who contributes the white matter. Now, we have two formidable enemies of the Jewish people. Who are the two formidable enemies of the Jewish people represented by Yaakov's formidable enemies? He has two enemies in his life. Two major enemies. Enemy number one was his own brother, Esav. What was Esav? Al kein karash shemo Edom. Esav was red. He had red hair, but also he worked, he related to Yaakov with a fury, with an emotional response. He was a warrior, a bloody warrior. He would hunt. He would kill animals. He was an emotional person, Esav. Angry at him. Crying that he didn't get the before, or that he got the blessings were stolen from him. Esav represents the red emotional foe of the Jewish people. On the other hand, Yaakov has another foe in his life, and that's none other than Lavan. What does the word Lavan mean? It means white. Yaakov's other enemy in his life was not a warrior, not an emotionally angry person, but a cunning, tricking person, swapping the daughters, ultimately tricking him into staying for another 7 years and another 7 years. Right? That's a cerebral enemy of the Jewish people. That's Lavan, the white, cerebral, and Esav, the red, which is emotional. Coming back to the Seder, we have three matzahs. Those three matzahs represent the three forefathers. The three forefathers represent that which is cerebral. What color is matzah? Off-white. It's white. The matzah is cerebral. How is the matzah cerebral? When you eat the matzah, what do you feel? Hungry. You eat the matzah, and it's not really the greatest tasting thing. How do you relate to the matzah? What is meaningful about the matzah? Not what you feel when you eat it, but what you think about when you eat it. You think about how there wasn't enough time for the bread to rise, and therefore you got matzah. You have to think about the meaning in order to appreciate the mitzvah. The white matzahs represent the three forefathers, because the father is cerebral, it's the white, it all connects. And the four mothers represent the red blood emotion. We know that the halacha is you're supposed to have not just wine for the four cups, but it should be red wine for the four cups. Those four cups, when you drink them, do you think about anything in order to experience it? No, you just feel it. When you drink wine, it's an emotional connection. It goes into your bloodstream, your red blood cells, and it gives you a certain sense of excitement. You feel the freedom. The three white matzahs represent the cerebral aspect of the Seder, the cerebral aspect of Jewish history and our enemies, and the four red cups of wine represent the four foremothers and the emotional aspect of the Seder. We say at the beginning of the Seder, Afilu kulanu chachamim, kulanim yod, kulanu yodim es haTorah. Even if we were all brilliant, we were all cerebral, we were all like the white matzahs, we understood exactly what we had to do, nonetheless, Mitzvah aleinu l'saper b'yitzias Mitzrayim. Even though we all know the story, we come to the Seder every year, we know the story already. We fulfill the matzah, we can think about it from today to tomorrow. We already know the story, but nonetheless, we still have to experience it and connect to it emotionally. That's why it's mitzvah l'saper b'yitzias Mitzrayim. A story is not just information. It's not just an encyclopedia. It's instead an emotional pull. It's something that grabs you. It pulls at your heartstrings when you hear a story about somebody. And that's the purpose of the Haggadah. That's the purpose of the Seder night. Yes, you have the informational aspects of the Seder. You have the cerebral aspects of thinking about what actually happened then. The matzah, the white, the forefathers, the lavan. But then you also have to connect emotionally. You have to have those four cups of wine. You have to experience the emotional pull that comes with the wine and also the story of us getting out of Egypt. That is one large general idea from the Shla, although I think it was maybe, you know, finessed by others later than the Shla, but it's built on the Shla, who says that the three matzahs are based on the fathers and the four kosos are based on the mothers. So that's the Shla in a very, you know, very snippet for Pesach. You could use that at your Seder. And that's where it comes from, the brilliance of the Shla and the book, which is so eclectic in, you know, talking about the Parsha, talking about Kabbalah, talking about Eretz Yisrael. In some ways, the book itself represents his life. He was an eclectic person. He grew up in Ashkenazic traditional rabbinic Jewry, and then he moves, you know, he gets thrown out here, he gets thrown out there. The idea of needing a place like Eretz Yisrael to be your ultimate salvation. He moves to Eretz Yisrael, he has that aspect of his life, he goes to live in Tzfat, he has the Kabbalah aspect of his life, and it all comes to the fore with this one book called the Shla, the Shnei Luchos HaBris, which within which he has all these different sort of identities of his life. He has the Eretz Yisrael stuff, and he has the mysticism stuff, and he's got the Musar stuff, and it's all in there with one beautiful potpourri of his own life mixed in, so that we can gain from it and we can learn from it. So the next time you hear the Shla being quoted in a shir or in some kind of Dvar Torah, hopefully you'll understand where he comes from, the immense richness of his life and therefore his teachings from the 17th century in Ashkenazic Jewry. Okay, that's the Shla. Everyone should have a good night. Mirat Hashem. If I don't see you, I think we'll have class next week for Mishle, but everyone should be well. And Sarita, have a safe trip back. All right. Be well, everyone. Be well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Marsha. Thank you, Evan. Thank you, Sarita. Thank you, Hannah. Thanks,
thank
Steve.
You.
Thank you, Raina. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. Thank you. All the best. Be well. Have a good night.
Thank you.